Hi, my name's Eric Lyle. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Eric.
This is for tall people. Some of you know my wife Penny, and she did this a few months ago, last summer or whatever, and it's difficult for me, at least. I can't speak for her, to not, when I'm reflecting on this and thinking about what I'm going to be doing for the next 7 weeks, not to think about our story. Because our story started when we were teenagers, and it was really intertwined, and we ended up getting sober together. And I think the only reason why we didn't get divorced after a couple years was because we had effective sponsorship right from the beginning. And her sponsor and my sponsor both said, you know what, I'm here to lead you through these steps to spiritual awakening. And what you should probably do is get sober and then kind of, as a couple, look at where you're at and where you want to go. And that was some of the best advice I ever got. And if it wasn't for good sponsorship, I know I wouldn't have stayed sober. And I certainly know we wouldn't have remained married all these years. So thank you to the fellowship and you people for giving us that when we got here. My sobriety date, September 18th, 1985. I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous shortly after I turned 23 years old. I took my first drink in August of 1974. And I could talk about my life up to that first drink, but I think I save that till step four. I can tell you I came from a loving home, two wonderful parents. We were poor, and I didn't really know that. But all my needs were met. But more importantly, they loved me, and they showed me love. I'm going to qualify here real quickly and then get to when I was introduced to the steps. You know, that summer of 74, I was starting to hang out with some guys who were a little bit older than me, 13, 14, 15 years old, and they were partying. And I had that opportunity on that fateful Friday night to be somewhere where I told my parents I wasn't going to be. I was going to be someplace else doing something different than I told them I'd be doing. And, I remember it like it was yesterday, because it was a gorgeous August, summer evening, 7 o'clock, bonfire, cottage, out in the country, bunch of cases of 16-ounce Budweisers. They were really cold. And now, mind you, I had not had a drink up to this point. My only experience with alcohol was my one uncle on my maternal side, who every holiday, Thanksgiving or Christmas, would disappear for like half hour at a time. And I didn't quite know what was going on until later on. And I found out, he was either going in the basement to drink or walking a half a block down the street to the VFW, doing a couple double shots and coming back. He died an alcoholic death, but I didn't see that, and he died after I got sober, and then I realized what a miserable way to die. He drank himself to death sitting in his garage. So that was my only experience with alcohol, but I'm with these guys, we're out there, ice cold beer, hot summer evening, could smell the fresh cut hay. I mean, I can remember this. And I cracked that first Budweiser and took a big chug of it, and that didn't last me but about 5 minutes, and I was cracking a second one. I can tell you this, I loved the taste of alcohol from that first drink. I mean, different alcohols have different textures, I found out, different tastes, and do different things, some more quickly than others. Everclear grain alcohol does it real quick, and I drank my share of that stuff. And about halfway through that second beer, I started feeling it. And up to this point, my shoulders were always up around my ears. I did not feel comfortable ever. And I had no reason not to feel comfortable. I didn't feel comfortable with my friends, really. I mean, I was kind of not comfortable with these guys on some level. But about halfway through that second drink, my shoulders kind of started easing up. And probably halfway through that third beer, I said, you know what? I feel okay. And we were having fun and, you know, loud music and all that stuff teenage boys do when they're drinking. And I'm told I drank six. You know, partway through the fourth one, I have what I know is a blackout. I drank a couple more. Passed out. Was kind of an idiot. You know, we all are when we, or at least I was. Woke up in the lawn, lying in my own vomit the next morning with the sun shining in my face. And it was like somebody turned on a light switch, because my first thought was, I need to do this again as soon as I can. It was like an epiphany. It was literally like somebody turned on a light switch. And I can tell you that I didn't drink every day from there on out, but I thought about booze. And to keep things in context, it was 1974, and there was a lot of other stuff going on, and I was in the middle of all of it. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about that. And some of that may have accelerated my entry into Alcoholics Anonymous. Doesn't matter, really. I got here when I got here, you know. And I thought, man, I want to do this again as soon as I can. And things just escalated from there, and it was kind of gradual. I mean, I lied to my parents, and, you know, I got home later that day, and they knew nothing. You know, by that time, I kind of shook it off and got on with things, you know, and I did all that stuff we did living out in the county. You know, we went hunting, we went fishing, we played sports. I did all that stuff. I mean, I was playing Little League Baseball when I had my first drink, you know, and I was smoking pot. You know, it was just, that's what I did. But I can tell you that just about every weekend I drank, and just about every weekend from then till the time I got sober, I had a blackout when I drank. I was a blackout drinker from the get-go. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. Nor did I think there was anything wrong with driving drunk when I got my driver's license at 16 years old. I worked on a farm part-time. You know, I could drive a tractor before I had a driver's license, you know, and haul a wagon around. It wasn't a big deal. It's just what I did. You know, in hindsight, I'm thankful that I didn't kill anybody. You know, I did some crazy, crazy stuff when I was drinking. But that progression got pretty rapid, and I can stand, and I had some fun. I had a lot of fun drinking and doing that stuff. But by the time I graduated from high school, and, you know, I didn't go to college. I actually went to college my senior year of high school, took some classes at Edinburgh at night, and, you know, that was just another opportunity to drink in a bar, quarter drafts, you know, in Pennsylvania. I didn't have to go to New York anymore because I had served at one of the joints. And some of the, you know, water seeks its own level, man. In the first class, you know, in college, I'm looking around the room at the people that are like me, and we know each other, you know, and I gravitated towards them, and they did me too, you know. But it was a gradual, well, pretty rapid spiral after I graduated from high school. You know, there's things that went on that were dark and ugly, and you know, I might touch base on those a couple weeks down the road. But eventually, I couldn't stop drinking, and I was barely employable. And my wife and I really, we didn't drink well together the last couple of years, that's for sure. That always ended up in a brawl, usually in the parking lot of some bar. But my last year, I knew if I picked up a drink, all bets were off. You know, I could go into the bar after work on a Wednesday night, and my supervisor would be there, and I'd have a couple beers, and he'd have a beer and get a six-pack to go, and he says, "I'll see you in the morning, Eric." And as sincere as I am tonight, right now, I would look him in the eyes and say, "Yep, Merle, I'll see you at 6 o'clock." And he might not see me till the following Tuesday. And the day I finally was at that jumping off point and called into work, they're like, "Well, do you really need to go to rehab? Maybe you should just get it together and, you know, come in Monday and we'll figure this out." I'm like, "Nah," because by this point, I can't get any relief from alcohol. Not for a minute. That feeling I had that first night where I felt okay, I can't get there. And my last drunk was at home with Penny and another, one of the guys I had my first drink with. And we started drinking after work, and it's like 3 in the morning, and I didn't even black out that night. I was just done. Every day I woke up and thought about killing myself. And I just tried to drink that away, and it wouldn't go away that night. And I thought, something's got to change. And I knew nothing about this. The only thing I knew about was that one Sunday night, sitting on the sofa drinking beer, I watched this a PSA ran by Serenity West. And for some reason, I sat there and watched the whole thing. And I thought, well, maybe there's a different way to do this. And that was a few weeks prior to me getting sober. But, you know, I ended up in a treatment center, and that was it. You know, I about 3 days in, I was finally able to kind of get what those big 12-step things said up on the wall. And I got down to God, and I walked out of that day room and went to my room and started packing my bag. And a young lady that was a nurse in that treatment center, who was also in the fellowship, she was 2 or 3 years sober, sat me down and talked to me about God as we understand God and higher power. Kind of put my mind at ease enough that I stayed there. And what they did for me is they gave me one of these books and they took us to meetings. I was incapable of understanding any of the medical stuff about alcoholism, but I got out of there, and about the second or third meeting that I attended, a gentleman walked up to me and introduced himself and said, I'll sponsor you. Now, I think this was arranged by this woman from the rehab. I really do, and she's never admitted to it, but I'm pretty certain it was. And I said, yeah, I need a sponsor. So we sat down that night, and he said some things to me, but and some of them I certainly am not going to repeat here. And there were things I needed to hear. He really got my craw. He was very black and white. But he says, what you're going to do is you're going to take that book, you're going to open it up to the preface, and you're going to read to 164. I'll give you 2 weeks to do that. And I had to call him long distance. This is 1985. There were no cell phones. And I was broke. So I had to call this dude like every other day, long distance. And you know, those were brief conversations. If there was whining, he stopped it real quick. You know, if I said, well, Penny did, he says, I don't sponsor her, man. And he said, you get through that after 2 weeks, then I'll agree to do this thing with you. He says, we're going to do it in a rapid manner. And if you're not open to the solution, that's fine. And, you know, we don't have a lock on this, but this is all I know. This is the only thing I know. And so I love to read. I loved reading. That's the one thing I didn't lose, is my love of reading. So I read through that, and you know, we talked, and he says, okay, go back to the doctor's opinion and read it, read Bill's story. And he says, and you tell me where the first step is. And I'd call him up, and I says, well, I think it's this, I think it's that. He says, no, that's not it, man. Well, where's it at? He says, I'm not going to tell you. You got to find it, man. You got to show some willingness here. And I eventually found it and called him up. And we sat down and talked about it, about what it was and what it wasn't. You know, the doctor's opinion I understood. By this point, I could see that pattern. Once I physically picked up a drink, I was 2 drinks away. As soon as I took the first one, I'm thinking about the third drink, you know. And I clearly recall, you know, being at like Sherlock's, and it's 10 o'clock at night, and I order another one of those quarts of kamikazes, and I'm thinking, this is the one that's going to get me right there where I need to be. But, you know, I got this craving kicking in, and I keep drinking. And unfortunately, I get past that, things are perfect, into the blackout, and then bad stuff happens every time. So we talked about, you know, the first step and the doctor's opinion and this, you know, this craving, this physical allergy and the mental obsession. He said, well, you know, the powerlessness part, you seem to understand that you take a drink and it produces this craving. He says, it's the unmanageability that a lot of folks I see stumble on. You know, my life had become unmanageable. And in my mind, I kept going back to, well, you know, my parents kicked me out of their home at 19. I'm barely employable. I'm in this marriage that I really don't want to be in, but I'm staying there because of fear. You know, I'm looking at all this stuff, which was a result of my unmanageable thought. And that was the crux for me, you know. All this weird stuff that happened was just a result of the physical craving when I took a drink, having no defense over that. And then my thought process, which was just consumed with fear and selfishness. I mean, I was afraid of everything, and nothing I saw was real. And that's the part, and I'm going to read a couple things here, because these are some of the most, the stuff about the first step is some of my most favorite things. You know, on 30, it says, most of us have been unwilling to admit we are real alcoholic. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. I did that every time I took a drink. Tonight's going to be different. You know, Thanksgiving Eve. Tonight's going to be different, Penny. We're not going to drink wild turkey. And we're not going to go to our parents and screw up their holiday tomorrow. But it happened every time. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. I was at that point that night. And here's the paragraph. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we are alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. Every thought I had was delusional. And I didn't see that when I was getting loaded, but I certainly was able to start seeing that when I took this first step. That my every action that I did was based on delusional information. The data was skewed. You know, it's like the accountant cooking the books. You know what I mean? My whole life was like that. I lost the ability to control my drinking. I don't know if I ever had it. I mean, I did at a level where I had enough sense in the beginning that I knew I couldn't drink before school because that was going to cause some problems. And I don't want problems because I want to keep drinking. So I'm going to manage this at the beginning. At the end, those last 2-3 years, I didn't care. I didn't care that I was going to ruin my parents' Thanksgiving. I had this delusion that that night that we went out was going to be different. And it never was, ever. You know, to concede is to surrender to a fact, you know. I mean, I could pull up some definitions, and I was looking at this, you know. Somebody once told me that I was going to drink because I didn't accept my alcoholism, and I disagree with that. I mean, I had to concede to this. I had to surrender to it, to the facts. You know, whether or not I accept it is irrelevant for me. It really is. So I went through this with him, and the progression, you know, was very rapid. Very, very rapid. And just about everything, I mean, I didn't end up in jail but for one night, only because I had a lot of policemen say, get your dumb ass home. Take some back road. We don't want to see you. You know, had I been doing what I was doing in the 70s and 80s now, I'd be in the state penitentiary or dead, you know. Some people would say, well, they enabled me. No, it was just a different culture then. I don't blame them for any of this, man. It's just the way it was. You know, bad things were happening, and I constantly thought about killing myself. So my thought was just so screwed, you know, so skewed and just goofy, you know. And believe me, there's days today when I have some goofy thinking going on. But the difference is that I also have a higher power that kind of stands between me and that action. And that's the difference. You know, I have a God consciousness today. In a level that I never imagined. And I was raised with religious and spiritual values. And we'll talk about that in the next couple steps. Because that was the crux for me once I got here. I can tell you this. I took this first step. Attended a meeting of AA every day for 10 months. And suffered from alcoholism. Because I refused to go on to 2 and 3. And we'll touch on that next week. You know, that was a miserable place to be. So today, you know, I just hooked up with a new guy a couple weeks ago, and we reviewed his first step New Year's morning, actually, over breakfast. It was nice, and it went to a meeting, and I haven't done something like that. I don't often go to a morning meeting. So it was nice, and a couple nights ago, we sat down and reviewed his second and third steps, and he started writing yesterday. You know, I don't want him to suffer the way I did in my own head. My sponsor, God bless him, he moved down south years and years ago, and kind of lost touch with him. I don't even know if he's still sober. But he was patient and tolerant. I think he saw a little bit of willingness, but I really resisted going on. I really did. But that's about where I'm at with that first step thing. I mean, I don't think this is... I mean, it's a crucial step for me, it was, but it was really easy to see this, you know, if I was honest to myself about how I drank, what type of alcoholic I was, and kind of keep that in context. That's the problem. The first step's the problem. You know, 2 and 3 are looking, you know, this is the solution, and then how are we going to get there? You know, how are we going to reach that spiritual awakening? So that's about all I have to share on that. So thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Now we have our question and answer portion of our meeting. Who has a question for Eric?
Thanks, Eric. My name's Marion, alcoholic. You said that the first sponsor that you had said, we're going to move on this.
Yeah.
So, did not to like say who didn't move on it, but if he wanted you to move on it and you read those pages in the first 2 weeks, what did he do when you got stuck on step one? What happened that you got so stuck on step one?
I didn't get stuck, and maybe I miscommunicated that. One wasn't the problem. It was 2 and 3. He was just very tolerant with me, because I think he saw a little bit of willingness, and I was still reading, and we were talking about the next two steps. But I did not want it to be a God solution, and that was all based in ego and false pride. And he probably afforded me more patience and tolerance those 9 months than I do some of my guys today, to be honest with you. I don't know what he saw in me at that time that I, you know, all I know, I think it was because I was continuing to read, and we were talking, and I was still calling him every other day, long distance, you know, and he actually had another new guy he picked up after me, and he was further along in his steps than I was. It was like, so what? I did not want it to be God. And so I wasn't stopped at step one. I just was refusing to go on. You know, I was still participating in Alcoholics Anonymous, this fellowship stuff, and I was making coffee for a meeting and all that stuff. But I wasn't doing the steps, and it was miserable. Penny has more than once said, you were more dark and depressed those 10 months than you were at the end of your drinking. It was terrible. I don't ever want to be there again. it was just a terrible place to be because I had untreated alcoholism. I just, you know, that kind of came to a crux, and I'll talk about that next weekend. So I don't know why he stuck with me, Marion. I really don't. You know, we never really talked about it. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Who else has a question?
Hi, Eric. I'm Bridget. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Hey, thank you for agreeing to share your experience, strength, and hope with us. And, you know, when you talk about your drinking and how this was what you thought about morning, noon, and night, so you say that you saw a commercial on television, and that was what kind of planted a seed?
Yes.
So would you say that you, at this point, had the gift of desperation, that you wanted something to change? Otherwise, you were going to do yourself in? Or, you know, what do you think actually caused you to actually take action, to seek help when you didn't have anybody, you know, around you that was doing that?
You know, that night, in retrospect, looking back on that, especially when I was newly sober, I thought, you know, the universe or spirit or God or whatever, for some reason I had enough of a moment of clarity that I sat there and watched that old show. Now, you know, once again, Penny's going to get drawn into this. She had been seeing an outpatient DNA counselor for like a year because I kept telling her she was an alcoholic, you know. That's how things rolled with us. And then she'd go get drunk afterwards. So, and say, see, that doesn't work. You know. And interestingly enough, she hadn't attended an AA meeting. But for some reason that night, I watched that because I knew something had to change. I mean, where I was at and where we were at, this is kind of intertwined. And it's sometimes I wonder, sometimes it's hard not to cross over that and talk about us together. One of us was going to die, and it was going to be at the other one's hands or some other way, but it was going to happen. And I knew that, and I just knew I had to do something different, or I was going to go grab the shotgun. I mean, there were nights when I had it in my mouth and my toe on the trigger, and she's telling me, do it, you know? There you go. Last time I told that story, I listened to the lead, and I hear this laughter that's unmistakable as Mary Ann. And it just put a smile on my face because, you know, it just is what it is. Where else can you tell that story and get people to laugh about it, you know? But that's where I was at that point, you know? And after we got sober, she said, well, I didn't know it was loaded. I said, all the guns were loaded. There wasn't just one of them. I had other reasons to be armed besides her, you know? So I had a moment of clarity and a moment of providence. You know, the reading today in the Daily Reflections, I read that every morning along with some other stuff, and I kind of chuckled because at the end of it, it talks about the first step in providence of a higher power and God. I thought, well, that's pretty appropriate for the gig I got tonight, you know? So, I, you know, all I can say is there was a power greater than me that at least made me comfortable and attentive for half an hour or an hour or whatever it was. You know, that's not what I typically did on Sunday night.
I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Ed.
So I guess my thought is when you're sponsoring a new guy and he takes that first step and is not open to the spiritual solution of the next couple steps, how do you? How long is your patience, or what's your response to that?
Well, that's on a case by case basis. I mean, I think you get a good feel for guys, but I also remember what was done for me, the grace I received. You know, it just depends. Sometimes, you know, I had a little bit of willingness, and I think my sponsor saw that, and he knew what the problem was, and he told me that. But I didn't want to believe him, and I also didn't want my folks to be right. You know. So it's just something I get a feel for, you know. you know, I sponsored a guy off and on for 20 plus years, and he never got more than about 18 months sober. And but he was like a brother to me. I loved him dearly, and he died, you know, as a indirect result of his alcoholism. And his point was four. 1, 2, and 3, we got through. It was four. You know, and so I kept taking him back when he'd show back up. So I don't know. I just kind of have a feel for it. I mean, I don't know if that's judgmental or not, you know, but I remember what my sponsor did for me, you know, and you know, I think you do this for a while and you know when you're getting shined or not, you know. You know, it says in 12, it kind of addresses this. And, you know, to paraphrase it, it talks about, you know, if they're not willing to look at a spiritual solution, at least be open to it, maybe you should go find somebody else that may not have the opportunity to hear the message. So I keep that in the back of my mind, but, you know, this particular gentleman I talk about was open to the spiritual solution. He just didn't want to look at the cause, you know, in four. You know, so I for me, it's not an open and shut, okay, after 32 days, we're done. You know, it just depends on where they're at, if that makes any sense.
Thanks, Eric. How important do you think it is to a person coming in, whether they're coming in on their own or they're on paper and they're forced to take it, that they've hit their bottom? How important that is that come into play with this step one?
I have no opinion on that one way or another. I mean, if they're willing to do this thing, we'll do it. Now, how they get here is out of my hands, you know. I've worked with people on paper that got sober. I've worked with people who've been through 12 rehabs that got sober. Why they became willing to do the action, I have no idea. You know, I mean, for me, I don't pick and choose. It's like when it's time for a new guy, stick my hand out, say, "You looking for a sponsor? I'll do this thing with you." You know, that, I mean, that's how I end up with new guys generally.
Oh, well, yeah.
You know, once in a while I'll get a call, or Penny will give my number to somebody's wife who's got a drunk husband or something, which is kind of a karmic circle that keeps going around with us. I mean, I don't know if that.
I don't know if you had any experience over the years.
I haven't kept track, you know. I mean, some of them been in and out. There was one that twice a year I'd get a call from the Erie County Jail, man. You know, but he'd get out and he'd be sincere for a while and we'd start doing it and then he'd stop doing it and he'd get loaded, you know. They kept me sober. You know, as a kind of a sidebar, this gentleman I'm talking about that I knew for over 20 years, when he appeared in my life, he called on the AA answering service, actually, and Penny and I did that once a month. And it was just shortly after she had been diagnosed with cancer. And we got this infant, you know, a year old daughter, and I'm just consumed by self. You know, I'm 8, 9 years sober, but I'm thinking, you know, I don't have much faith right now. At that point, you know, is she going to live? Is she going to die? Am I going to raise this kid by myself? I'm just consumed by self. Instead of, you know, my sponsor and one other friend told me when she was diagnosed, well, this is your opportunity to be loving and useful to your wife at another level. And I'm like, oh, that's, I mean, I'm not supposed to be whining in my own stuff. And they're like, yeah. But this guy called. And he told me a little bit of what was going on, and I says, well, you know, the woman thing, you know, we might talk about that at some point, but if you can't stop getting loaded, I'll take you to a meeting Friday night. And I spent that evening with him, and let me tell you, I had no problems compared to the hole this dude had dug. And that's just how this thing works for me. When every time life got a little weird, I ended up with a new guy. I think that's providence and grace, you know. I mean, I show up and stick out my hand, and, you know, he called that night, and he was a lifesaver, you know. He was a knucklehead, I'm telling you. I love him dearly. I got a picture of him next to my desk at home, and I look at him every morning after my meditation. He was a wonderful, wonderful human being. He just was unwilling to do the full deal here, you know. And so I stuck with him for a long time, you know. That's been my experience, and I don't think it's black and white totally. I mean, I really do believe what it talks about in 12. You know, fortunately, my sponsor saw a little bit of willingness. So there you have it.
Anybody? Thanks, Eric. Thanks for coming out here. You know, I know.
You're
I'm
welcome, gonna, Kevin.
I'm going to drag it out till 7:25. That's my job here.
Hey, I've been disappointing people for 57 years, Kevin. You know, why stop now?
Really, exactly. Anyway, when you talked about, you know, when you first talked to the person who you worked with at the beginning, he said, read the first 164 pages and then that'll tell me that you're willing. Do you do that with the people that you sponsor?
Oh, yeah.
What?
And I ask questions. I mean, we know enough by reading the text to know if they're reading it or not, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they read about 12 pages a day, they'd blow through it in 2 weeks. You know?
So that's what you do, you ask them to read that? And...
Yeah, we talk. And you ask questions. At least I do, you
okay.
know.
No,
and sometimes they don't, you know, it's like they're not looking for where's step one, where's step two, where's step three, but there's stuff in there.
Yeah.
You know, you'll get questions. One of the last times I was working through the steps with my buddy that I was with 20 years or so. This is funny. This will take a little bit of time.
Right.
It's a beautiful summer day, like July, hot out. And I get a phone call. It's my friend Jimmy. He says, what are you doing, E? He always called me E. I says, I was working around the house or something, doing some gardening. I says, what are you doing, Jimmy? He says, I'm out at the North Pier sitting on a picnic table. Beautiful day. I'm drinking some scotch and reading the big book, and I got a question. How could you fire that guy?
Yeah, really.
You know what I mean? I'm like, well, okay, what's the question? I can't even remember what it was now. But he was sincere. I mean, he was reading a book, drinking scotch. He just, you know, and he had a question. It was probably, I venture to guess, it was probably something about the inventory. Because that was the stumbling block for him, you know? How absolute and full do I have to be? How honest do I have to be with this thing? You know? Well, if it's a fear or resentment or some kind of sexual or other harm, you need to put it down there. I mean, you know, everybody's got their stuff, you know, but, you know, for me, you know, how could I walk away from him, you know? He was just one of those people that's once in a lifetime, really. I mean, he was a wonderful, wonderful human being. You know. You're welcome.
Thanks, Eric.
I will tell you that we're going to condense this into 7 weeks. Only because when Kevin asked me to do it and he told me the start date, I says, well, we need to get this done before March. Because it's fishing season approaching. So I came up with a schedule, but really, I think we'll get through this thing in 7 weeks and we'll have a nice time doing it. Thank you.